Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 1st of November. On the final weekend of the US presidential election campaign, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris converge on Wisconsin and Jamie Kumarasamy, who joins me from that critical swing state. We hear from those cleaning up their own towns in Spain as the country braces for a fresh deluge. Hello and happy birthday, Kitty, half a century of Japanese cuteness power. And how might the world look a century from now? I get a glimpse into the future at London's Natural History Museum. You're listening to The World Tonight with Sean Lay in London and James Kumarasamy, who's in Wisconsin, along with Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Hello, Jamie.
Hello there, Sean, and welcome to Milwaukee, the largest, most populous city in this Midwestern state of Wisconsin that has backed the winner of the last two presidential elections by the tiniest of margins, 0.7%. Both times. Well, last night, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris will be holding competing rallies within 15 minutes driving distance of each other in this city as part of what's being called their Blue Wall Blitz, a pre-election dash through the three states that make up the Blue Wall, a once faithfully Democratic trio, Michigan, Pennsylvania being the others, which now flip between Republicans and Democrats, much like this dairy-loving state's cherished butter burgers. Well, if Kamala Harris doesn't emulate Joe Biden's 3 out of 3 in Tuesday's election, her path to the presidency becomes much more precarious. Donald Trump has been in one of the other blue wall states, Michigan, this evening, speaking to its large Arab American population in the city of Dearborn, hoping to benefit from their concerns about the White House policy towards the Middle East.
You're going to have peace. You're going to have peace in the Middle East. And they should have peace in the Middle East, but not with the clowns you have in the Middle East. Let me tell you, what you have people in the Middle East that aren't doing their job, and you have people in the U.S. that aren't doing their job, and when they get it together, when they get it right, you're going to have peace in the Middle East.
His opponent, meanwhile, has been focusing on some of Mr. Trump's other war-related comments, specifically what he said to the ex-Fox News host, Tucker Carlson, about the former Republican Congresswoman turned Harris supporter, Liz Cheney.
She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with 9 barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
Well, when she arrived in Wisconsin, the current vice president addressed Donald Trump's comments about the daughter of one of her predecessors as VP.
Trump is increasingly, however, someone who considers his political opponents the enemy, is permanently out for revenge, and is increasingly unstable and unhinged. His enemies list has grown longer, his rhetoric has grown more extreme, and he is even less focused than before on the needs and the concerns and the challenges facing the American people.
So far, none of the campaign controversies seem to have separated the two candidates in the opinion polls, although it has to be said that here in Wisconsin, the polls seriously underestimated the Trump vote in the last two elections. The veteran Wisconsin pollster Charles Franklin of Marquette Law School did better than most, and his team says it's changed its data gathering methods to better capture the Trump support level. Well, after he published his final pre-election polling data this week, I asked Charles what it showed.
We've seen a little tightening of the race to now just a 1-point advantage for Kamala Harris, 50% to 49% for Trump. That's down from a 4-point Harris lead a month ago. But over the course of the year, we've seen Trump leading by a small amount in some polls, either Biden or Harris leading by small amounts. So it's been a very close race all year. And that contrasts with the relatively large Democratic leads that we saw in 2016, erroneously as it turned out, and in 2020, where the lead was somewhat smaller, but still an overestimate of the Democratic advantage.
Well, as a pollster, you have immediately addressed the elephant in the room, which is the polls didn't get it right the last two electoral cycles. Are you more confident this time round?
Well, ask me next Wednesday, and I'll tell you. Now, of course, it's possible that we are off by the same 4 points that my poll was off in 2020, in which case maybe Trump would be up by 3 points. That would be an unusually large margin here in Wisconsin, where four of the last six elections have been decided by less than one percentage point. So I think if you just look at electoral history, you would assume this is probably a one-point race. But 1 point for who? That I don't think we know.
What about issues? What are the issues that favor Trump and which are the ones that favor Harris?
The key thing we've seen all year long is that people rate the economy as the most important problem. And they say Trump will do a better job than Harris by about 10 percentage points in this final poll. Second top issue is abortion policy, which favors Harris considerably. And the third is immigration and the border, the southern border, which favors Trump.
Both candidates are spending a lot of time here in this closing week. What do you think their goal is?
At this point, I think it is maximize your turnout. 5% say they're undecided at this point. But the one that I think Harris does seem to be targeting are Republicans who have an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. These are the folks that didn't vote for him in the primaries. They're conflicted about him. So I think this last outreach to disgruntled Republicans does have a reason to go there to try to convince these folks that their dislike of Trump is enough to bring them to vote for a Democrat. But that is a heavy hurdle for most partisans to cross over.
So, Charles, last question, possibly unfair. How are you calling this?
I think this is a race that's so close that it would be no surprise if Donald Trump wins, and it would be no surprise if Kamala Harris wins. What would be a big surprise is if either of them wins by 3 points or more.
That's the veteran Wisconsin pollster Charles Franklin sitting sort of on the fence there. Well, as he said, the economy is the number one issue for voters in this state, as it is across America, in fact. And figures out today showed that job growth has slowed sharply, although unemployment does remain low. And statistics that were out earlier in the week showed that GDP grew by 2.8% in the last quarter. Despite all that, many Americans are still feeling the effects of the recent high inflation. We were told by the director of a network of food pantries, that's food banks in this part of Wisconsin, that the day those GDP figures were published, that was their busiest one ever. And I've been along to one of their food collection centers.
Good morning. All right, thank you.
It's getting pretty busy in what feels like a small supermarket. People pushing their shopping trolleys around, filling bags, some of which they've brought with them. And there's a variety of goods on display, herbs, fresh fruit and vegetables, milk, bread, treats for the kids, cans of all sorts of things. People are not paying, though. There's nothing here they have to pay for because this is a food pantry and it is run by a group called the Badger Prairie Needs Network. Everything for free, as I say, and very heavily used.
My name is Tracy Burton, and I'm the food pantry director at Badger Prairie Needs Network.
And how have numbers and needs changed over the years?
It's been incredible. We thought the pandemic was what was going to cause the huge increase, and we about doubled during the pandemic. We're now five times the pre-pandemic numbers. And that's really a result of the high food costs, inflation, and the high housing costs in the area. Most of the people that come to us are employed. About 70% have at least one job in their family, but that's not enough. And I think by talking to our guests, you found that it's just hard to make ends meet, and the cost of food is just crazy. And even though inflation has leveled off, the food prices haven't come down.
All right. Thank you for bringing your bags. You can pick a bonus item. Yes.
Many of those using the food pantry weren't native English speakers, but among those who were, we came across Leah struggling to make ends meet.
I am here more so because the prices of groceries have went skyrocket. Whether you make $20 an hour to $25 an hour, whether you're working full-time or part-time, is still tight when it comes to groceries. I am a single mother. It's stressful.
Are you in work at the moment, Leah?
Yes, I am.
But even with work, with a wage coming in, you're finding it tough to survive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very hard to pay for groceries now. Everything is so, so expensive, from the eggs to the bread. I've noticed, especially within this past year or two, more people are starting to come to pantries due to expenses being so high. It's kind of insane how long the lines can get.
How do you feel about that?
It's upsetting, because you kind of got to get in survival mode. Makes you wonder, like, okay, like, am I going to be able to survive later on in life? Like, what if these prices continue to skyrocket? Like, what will we do then at that point? Like, how will we survive at that point?
All right, some breaking new economic data this morning on a pretty major marker. The U.S. GDP grew 2.8% in the third quarter of this year.
This week brought more news about America's strengthening economy, but it doesn't impress Leah.
I'm kind of one of those people, I got to see the proof in the pudding. Like, they can put anything in the media, but once it's out and about and we're able to, you know, just see how everything works out, that's kind of how I go off of things.
But you don't feel it. So when you Absolutely. When you're getting your dollars out, you don't feel it.
No, not at all.
Yes, you're welcome.
And it's not just poorer people like the ones using this food pantry who don't recognize their own experience in the data which shows wages outpacing inflation. Laura Dresser is a labor economist at the University of Wisconsin.
In spite of the fact that on average I can show their wages went up faster than inflation, you know, that doesn't feel that way. And I think inflation, especially the levels we hit in 2022, was a completely new experience for almost every working person. People who are still in the labor market don't really remember the late 70s. And so it's a completely new experience and really disturbing. And it piles on top of underlying stress in workers, especially around the high cost items like housing, like childcare, and like healthcare in this economy.
That was the economist Laura Dresser on the distance between the economic data and how voters experience the economy in real terms. And Sean, among all of the noise of the final days of the campaign, that is probably the biggest challenge that faces Kamala Harris.
Yeah, Jamie, I was very struck by what Charles Franklin was saying to you there, that this could be decided by as little as one percentage point. If it really is that tight, do you have any sense from talking to people in Wisconsin of the factors that might swing it one way or the other there?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things. I think one thing that won't swing it away from Kamala Harris is a lack of being in this state in the way that it did to Hillary Clinton in 2016. She didn't turn up at all. But no, for Kamala Harris, she's certainly been here a lot. So has Donald Trump. It could be the smallest of things. And one interesting thing to look at, I think, is the third party candidates. On the one hand, you have Jill Stein from the Green Party, Cornel West, an independent who's on the ballot. They could take votes away from Kamala Harris. But on the other hand, interestingly, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., RFK Jr., who was on the ballot and it remains on the ballot, he's dropped out to endorse Donald Trump, but he tried to get his name taken off. The Supreme Court said no, so he is still on the ballot, and it's thought that some people might think he is still running, so he could get votes that would otherwise have gone to Donald Trump. Small, small margins, but it could all come down to that. Anyway, I'll be back on Monday on the eve of Election Day. I'll be looking at another key issue, immigration. I'll also be hearing about the hopes and fears of the woman with the unenviable task, given what happened 4 years ago, of making sure the voting and the vote counting in this state goes smoothly.
James Kumarasamy there in Wisconsin. You're listening to The World Tonight. Coming up later, happy birthday to a global ambassador of goodness. But we've a shocking revelation about Japan's most adored feline, Hello Kitty, is not a cat.
We don't like to think of her as a cat. We like to think of her as a little girl, as a friend. So Hello Kitty is not a cat.
Hello, Hello Kitty. Hello Kitty.
Well, tomorrow morning we'll find out who Conservative Party members have chosen to be their new leader, Kemi Badenoch or Robert Jenrick. A little shine may be taken off the victory by James Cleverly's announcement tonight that he won't accept a job in the shadow cabinet, whichever of his former cabinet colleagues becomes leader. Mr. Cleverly, who served as both Foreign Secretary and Home Secretary, was eliminated from the leadership contest by Conservative MPs in the final stage before the membership ballot. He wasn't the only one surprised.
Kemi Badenoch, 42 votes. James Cleverly, 37 votes. And Robert Jenrick, 41 votes.
Well, Katie Balls is political editor of The Spectator magazine. Katie, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Is there a similar degree of shock in the party by this announcement?
Probably not the same level of shock as when James Cleverly didn't make it into the final two. That was a very strange day. And of course, it was an anonymous ballot. Tory MPs are known for being an electorate that likes to surprise or turn on one another. But still, he wasn't the lead in the previous round. And I think they're still shocked to this day in the parliamentary party that he didn't make it to the final two. The news, as per the Financial Times, and it interviewed Lucy Fisher, that James Cleverly does not plan to have a role in the shadow cabinet, I think will come as a surprise and a disappointment to some in the party. But given he thought very hard about even going for this in the first place, he thought about spending more time with his wife, who has recovered from cancer, I think it's a decision some in the party will understand. However, it is probably going to fuel this idea that there is perhaps a prince across the water if things don't go to plan for the new leader.
Always a dangerous phenomenon for leaders in opposition, isn't it? The prospect there might be somebody who their colleagues might, after a few months, decide could do the job better. I wonder, though, if it looks, dare I say, a little graceless.
I think there is a question when James Cleverly obviously ran during the Tory leadership on a real unity ticket. So he was often talking about the need to unite. So I do think you have a few people in the party saying, OK, well, you talked about unite, but you don't want to unite to the point that you take on one of these briefs. However, I think that if you do look at the comments made by James Cleverly, it doesn't look as though he is saying, I'm going to go to the backbench and cause problems for the future leader. And I think there's probably a sense, if you look across the Tory party, of lots of figures who served continuously in the Tory government, who are pretty worn down, and perhaps I see opposition as a chance to have a slight break. But it definitely is a warning sign, because the problem, even if James Cleverly had made the final two, is not a single one of the three final candidates had more than a third support of the parliamentary party going into the final two. James Cleverly was just knocked out by a tiny handful of votes. And that does mean the task of uniting when you only have one third support, which is what Kemi Badenoch or Robert Jenrick has, no matter who wins, is really tricky. And I think James Cleverly saying he's not going to play a role in the shadow cabinet does make that task harder.
Just one last brief thought. It does presumably mean that whoever wins tomorrow won't be overshadowed by having such a big beast on the team.
Yes, but of course you do tend to have a big beast who could say anything at Prime Minister's questions or give an interview at any point. So I don't think it eliminates it. But I think whoever wins, they will need to try and create some unity in the cabinet, shadow cabinet.
Katie Balls from The Spectator, thank you so much. What might our natural world look like 100 years from now? And will knowing what's likely help us to appreciate more readily the threats that exist now? This week, visitors to London's Natural History Museum have been finding out, thanks to a combination of French technical know-how and informed scientific prediction. This afternoon, I went along for the experience and met the team behind it.
Hi, I'm Kate Whittington. I'm an exhibitions and interpretation manager here at the Natural History Museum, and I'm excited to welcome you to Visions of Nature, our mixed reality experience.
So I'm Max Barclay. I'm the curator of beetles, which are one of the most diverse group of organisms on the planet, but they do include fireflies.
And fireflies feature in this virtual reality world of 100 years hence.
There's a wonderful display in there of fireflies in a tropical forest, and you can see them flying all around you and lighting up the treetops.
We are now high in the canopy of a tropical rainforest. Those lights are fireflies. Look all around you.
I have been in a tropical forest and I've sat surrounded by fireflies, but in the experience you can actually have one that comes and lands on your finger, and it's a completely accurate firefly, which of course appeals to me, but it's also incredibly beautiful.
Kate, tell me, how much is changing now that makes you think actually a lot is going to change in that 100 years, and somehow we have to map that for the users, the customers, the clients who come here?
Well, I think what struck me in putting it together is actually 100 years sounds like a long time away, but evolutionarily it's a blink. Actually, one of the big challenges of the planetary crisis is that change is happening at a much faster rate than animals, flora and fauna are used to adapting at, particularly with doing a mixed reality experience. One of the really great benefits of that is that it's a shared experience. You can see the people and the things around, and you can react together and collectively to that. And then that hopefully sparks conversations afterwards about the kind of future that we want to see and that we want to create together.
So if a family come into the museum, they can put the headsets on together and they can experience the same event, the same moment, the same scene at the same time.
Yes, it's all completely synchronised and you'll all do the same interactions, but for example, you'll all be invited to release a Darwin's frog into its new habitat and you'll have your very own one to release, but you'll be able to enjoy that experience with the people next to you.
Perfect. OK, so, hello, yeah. Welcome hello. To Visions of Nature.
Oh, I can see the map now, it's in front of you.
Great, cool.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
No, I'm looking forward to it.
Amazing, your experience will start very soon if you just want to jump
walk into this box. OK, yeah. Thank you. So the first thing I've got is a map of the world, and it's got highlighted different parts. Oh, here we go. Show's starting.
This is the future. The year 2125. These stories show how our decisions and actions can support other species to survive.
A horned beast over there.
Do you recognise the animal that just brushed past you? It's a Eurasian lynx.
Oh, that's beautiful.
We are
it's a lynx in the Scottish forests.
Ooh. The lynx has restored an ecology of fear, where prey live on constant watch once more. This leaves the deer less time to graze and can result in fewer offspring.
Apart from my own experience, I've just had the very strange experience of watching a group of people wearing these headsets, holding their hands out as if there was something in front of them, turning around and gazing in astonishment at what are basically blank walls. I wonder what they thought of the experience now they've got their headsets off.
I think virtual reality and digital aspects of museums really help to bring in lots of different audiences. So I think it's really good that the Natural History Museum are putting something like this on.
I thought it was very interesting. It's very well made and it's very positive about the future, which is obviously a good thing, but it might not be telling the whole truth.
Very great. Yeah. Very massive. It's really great.
Merci.
Just a flavour of some of the visitors to the Visions of Nature mixed reality experience at the Natural History Museum. It's available every day. The main headlines so far on the world tonight at approaching 10:30. Donald Trump is in Dearborn, Michigan, the largest Arab-majority city in the United States, as campaigning enters its final stages before Tuesday's presidential election. And the Spanish authorities have extended a red alert for torrential rain on the southern coast after flash flooding killed more than 200 people in eastern areas on Tuesday. Dozens remain missing, mainly in the Valencia region, after rapidly rising waters trapped people indoors. Some residents say more lives could have been saved if the authorities had been quicker to warn of the flood risk. Thousands of volunteers are helping the Spanish military and emergency services with the rescue and cleanup operation. One of them is Juan Gonzalez, an English teacher who arrived to donate a bag of supplies outside a food distribution point in Valencia.
Recently, my neighbour just this morning told me that a little baby was found dead inside a car, and the parents were missing. So, yeah. It's a mix of anger and sadness. Sadness because people that are not here have gone through a terrible agony until they passed away. And anger because it's a rage that, you know, our local government didn't do anything about it, knowing. They well knew that, you know, this was coming and did nothing about it. Even now, you know, it's like there are people saying that they want to come and help and they're not allowing them to come. So devastating, really.
Local resident Juan Gonzalez in Valencia. Now back to the United States, and with early voting well underway and polling day itself within sight, this seems a good point to explore some of the terminology. OK, jargon that's likely to be mentioned during next Tuesday's coverage. And who better to turn to than the veteran US watcher, former BBC Washington correspondent Nick Bryant, who's recorded a series of helpful election explainers for The World Tonight. This one is about ballot initiatives.
Though our focus, naturally, is on the contest for the White House, voters will also be taking part in congressional elections to decide the makeup of the House of Representatives and Senate. This year in 41 states, they'll also be presented with what are called ballot initiatives. These allow citizens to propose laws or amendments to their state constitutions and to collect enough signatures to get them on the ballot. Sometimes these ballot initiatives are also proposed by state legislatures. Ballot initiatives have been passed in 13 states and the District of Columbia to legalize marijuana. They've been used to allow same-sex marriage. In California, they impacted how the criminal justice system is run, especially the sentences meted out to repeat offenders. This year across the country, there are almost 150 ballot initiatives, touching on topics such as the minimum wage, drug use policy, and whether non-citizens should be allowed to vote in state or municipal elections. Just in case you're wondering, they can't vote in presidential elections. But the issue receiving the most attention is abortion, following the Supreme Court ruling in 2022, which overturned Roe v. Wade and curbed reproductive rights for women. Voters in 11 states will decide abortion-related ballot measures, and two of them are swing states, Arizona and Nevada, which the Harris campaign hopes will boost turnout. In a close election, small factors matter, so we'll be keeping a close eye on the impact of ballot initiatives that commonly get overlooked.
Nick Bryan, former BBC Washington correspondent, author of The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself. He'll have a further postcard explaining another aspect of the election on Monday's programme. People with psychosis struggle to stay in touch with reality. They can hallucinate, for example, hearing voices. But what if the sufferer could see the voice and so confront it? That's the idea behind an experimental therapy involving digital avatars. Philippa Garrity, Professor of Clinical Psychology at King's College London, lead author of the study, which has just been published in the journal Nature Medicine, spoke to the BBC's Tim Franks.
The way it works is that we discuss with people who hear voices what exactly it is they hear, and we worked out to understand where they think the voice is coming from, what the source of the voice, what it looks like. And then with computer software, we sit down with them and we create their own personalized avatar to serve as the source of their voice. That starts with using special software to create the voice as it sounds like the voice that they hear. That software is going to transform the therapist's voice into the sound of the voice that they hear, so that the therapist, in some dialogues, will be able to, as the avatar, be the voice that the person interacts with. Then, after creating the voice, and that's often very successfully done, people say that they find it uncanny how much it sounds like the voice they hear, they create a face. It can be a human face, or it may be a non-human face, like a devilish character. Whatever it is, they imagine their voice looks like. And that then becomes an animated face which speaks, and we enable the person to have a dialogue with their voice, where the focus is on helping people no longer to feel controlled by the voice.
Right. To be very clear about this, is the avatar then, it's not using artificial intelligence to create a conversation with the person. It is the therapist who is, in a sense, yes, having the conversation.
Yes, right. That's right. It's a live voicing of the dialogue with the therapist choosing what to say. And the way it works is that at the very beginning, the therapist will always use verbatim phrases, phrases that the voice hearer has told the therapist that the voice uses. They have often not explained to anybody what the voice says because the content is often upsetting or shaming. Mm-hmm. But in order to establish the real experience of the avatar as their voice, we will use those phrases, and then we will help very quickly people to stand up to and challenge where the phrases are bullying or abusive, which they frequently are in psychosis, and that's the point.
What I wonder, though, is whether, in a sense, to come up with this idea and to test it has been a bit of a risk, obviously a calculated risk, because I guess part of you must have been thinking, you know, are we risking sort of giving concrete form to something which is being hallucinated? Could we, in a sense, make it more real for the patient?
That's an understandable and good question. And I think the first thing to say is that they are there. Those voices are experienced as real, often omnipresent in the person's life. And in fact, what we found is that people feel empowered by creating this image and sound, which is slightly outside them. They often report feeling that this has given them more power over a thing which actually they are experiencing day by day in their head. The history of working with people with psychosis is that over the past few decades, we used to be told, don't reinforce the voices that people hear by talking about them. That's when I started in my field. And I was part of a movement of psychologists saying, well, they are experiencing these phenomena. We need to understand them better and help them. And what we found is that by creating the avatar, they often feel not that they're making them more real, they're already real, but that they can now look at them in a more dispassionate and controlling way.
Professor Philippa Garrity talking to Tim Franks about psychosis avatars. If you don't recognise the tune, it's the soundtrack from one of the many animations featuring a Japanese character who in half a century has conquered the world simply by being nice. Hello, Kitty. For some of you listening, those two words may have been enough to trigger a warm, comforting tingle down the spine. She turns 50 today, the embodiment of a venerable Japanese tradition known as kawaii, cultural representations of cuteness. Hello Kitty's commercial popularity is unarguable. As well as cuddling her, you can wear her, slippers or false nails. You can even make love with the Hello Kitty condom. But what about Kitty as a tool of soft power? I've been talking to Christine Yano, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of Hawaii. She's written Pink Globalization, Hello Kitty's Trek Across the Pacific. Professor Yano began by describing the character, which the Japanese company behind it, Sanrio, says isn't a cat at all. It's a girl.
She's got a big round head, and she's an abstraction of a cat or a little girl.
She and does so appear to have whiskers, doesn't she?
She has whiskers. Oh, you've been noticing. But the lines are very simple. The design is actually quite elegant in that kind of storybook way, which almost references more like Danish abstraction, so Japanese abstraction. So indeed, she's not drawn with a mouth, but that doesn't mean she doesn't have one. Because what many Western observers, especially feminists, pounce on, and I'm using that word deliberately, is, but she has no mouth, meaning she is disempowered. She has no ability to speak for herself.
No
she
agency.
Has no agency, et cetera, et cetera. And when I pose that to Japanese or to Sanrio themselves, they say, of course she has a mouth. We just didn't feel it necessary to draw it in. And indeed, in early Hello Kitty cartoons, she does have a mouth and she is definitely speaking.
Right.
So, you know, there goes that kind of criticism.
What about the idea that she is, in a sense, an embodiment of a much older tradition in Japanese? And it has a word, I think, which I will leave to you to say because you will pronounce it correctly, that roughly translates as a kind of Japanese cultural idea of cuteness.
Oh, kawaii. So that's K-A-W-A-I-I, kawaii. And cute is probably the closest English gloss. But as in many Japanese concepts, it has a lot of variety of meanings, and they're all meant to be invoked at the same time. And so there's cuteness, but there can be ugly cuteness, there can be warped cuteness, mm-hmm. there can be various kinds of things. But it draws upon kind of the, if you will, the parent-child kind of bond of being needed and needy all at the same time. So it's that bond of caring.
What about the criticism that in some ways it kind of is an infantilizing concept, particularly for young girls, that it teaches them a kind of an unrealistic view of the world? And some people want to hang on to that much older than perhaps is healthy.
And I would probably be one of those that says such a thing. At the same time, think of how that can be manipulated and think of how the world can revolve around the infant, the child that says, give me, give me.
and then everybody jumps to give, right? So, you know, yes and no. Infantilizing, yes, but how about infantilizing to a purpose? And how about infantilizing to the point of allowing adults to, and I'm going to sound almost Freudian here, to call upon the infancy within themselves?
That's really interesting. You've mentioned that, because I saw a quote in an interview with an American woman who is herself, as she said, some age over 50. And she leads a group in the United States, in California, the Hello Kitty SoCal Babes. And here's what she had to say. She likes to spend hours among the soft toys. Something in my inner child gets healed, she said. Is that what you're getting at there? A sense that perhaps for some adults, it's actually a kind of a really valuable way to kind of refresh that part of their identity.
Absolutely. And you know, everybody can have their own reason for, let's turn her into a verb, into Hello Kittying, whether it's self-healing or whether it's more public kind of performance. Everybody can have their own reason. But also part of what I'm suggesting is not a bad thing for societies in general. Societies that are so used to crises and division and strife, that what about taking a breather from the weightiness of that? And how about something light that might lighten us? And then it kind of turns that woman's words a little bit on its heads, right? It's a kind of self-care, perhaps, but perhaps it's a societal care.
What about Kitty's role in kind of changing cultural perceptions of Japan? I mean, she was first drawn in the mid-1970s, a little under 30 years since the end of the Second World War, a time of which perhaps Japan had undergone an enormous amount of change, but also needed to be seen in a different way by the outside world. Did she play a part in that, do you think?
I think so, absolutely. I don't believe that the government at all was involved in her initial spanning the Pacific, but it was certainly Shintaro Tsuji's goal to make this a global character. And he had Mickey Mouse in mind. So she was supposed to be the Japanese cat that would overtake the American mouse, right? And so this had nothing to do with governments, but it had everything to do with globalism and Japan as a corporation, individual aspirations to be part of the bigger world beyond Japan.
And to be presumably no longer perceived as a threatening force, but in the region.
So, I mean, if you think of the end of World War II and then the striving, the economic striving of Japan after that, and what if Japan could take on yet another face that was seen as more human, right? Not the war monster and not even the downtrodden hard worker, but what if Japan could take on a playful face?
Professor Christine Yano at the University of Hawaii. And now it's time for me to say goodbye, Kitty. That's the World Tonight.